Hi, everybody. Dean Criss back in the studio. Man, I am so excited this week. We're going to have with us Chip Hughes, who is a major at the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. Chip has got a world of experience in policing. He's been at many levels of the organization. He's also a senior, not executive, but a senior consultant with Arbinger Institute. And Chip has just been a keynote speaker. He's done a TED Talk, and he's just, you know what, he's got a lot of experience in leadership. He's also in the midst of his organization doing a little defunding the police. We'll have a little conversation about that. But I think he's going to have some things for us that we're going to really enjoy. So as we always say, sit back, turn up the volume, get ready to change your life. Hi, I'm Dean Criss. Welcome to Straight Talk on Leadership. This is what we'd like to say is the No BS Zone, where we give you leadership tips, ideas, and practical suggestions to help you become a top leadership performer. Our goal is simple: help you become the best version of yourself and reach your highest potential as a leader. So sit back, turn up the volume, be ready to change your life. Hi, folks. Dean Criss back in the studio here again in Torrington, Wyoming. I'm coming to you live today. Well, not so much live, but we're probably taped. But coming from me on the podcast for this week from Torrington, Wyoming, I'm going to be joined with Kelly Corvin, who is our business development coordinator for LHLN. She has been busy booking classes. She's been busy doing a lot of work. And man, we've had some strategic planning sessions the last couple of weeks. We got some exciting things to talk about. You've had a chance to talk about that. But we're really joined and we're excited to welcome in Chip Hughes, who is the major at the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, been there 29 years, is also a executive consultant or a chief consultant for the Arbinger Institute. If you're not familiar with that, they've written several books. The Outward Mindset's one. The other one I can think of is The Leader in the Self-Deception. And Chip will tell you all about those things when we get talking to him. But he's had quite the career, and he's got a lot of experience. And one thing I really like about him, reading his bio and talking to him, is his man, he is a student of leadership. And when you're a student in the leadership, you got a lot of things you can talk to folks about. So as we always do in our program, we would like to add value to your life, give you things that can change your life. And so, Kelly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here and fun to be with a fellow Kansas Cityan. Go Royals.
We're assuming that's Chip. So, Chip, good to have you with us today, my friend.
Well, thank you, Dean, and thank you, Kelly. It's just a genuine pleasure to be able to speak with you guys this afternoon.
And also, Chip has a podcast himself and Changing the Discourse. And if you want to check over there, we'll see if we can't get his numbers up a little bit on his podcast. Go over and have a chance to listen in to what he's talking about. And Chip's quite got the experience. Chip, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, let's see how far back you guys want to go. We could start with childhood. I will tell you, I think it's germane to our conversation and why I got into law enforcement. So I'll start back with a little bit of my history. I was raised kind of a very unique way. My father was a clinical psychopath and a career criminal. And my mother struggled with mental health issues of her own, and we were homeless and fostered and in shelters throughout my first 11 years of my life, moving all around the country. And we came in contact with cops a lot, especially when my dad was putting marks on my mom or me, and the police would come and they would rescue us. They'd take my dad to jail, or sometimes they'd take us to a shelter. They found us sleeping in a car. They'd take us to a Salvation Army. A lot of my early experience with police were very positive in the sense that they were the protectors. That drove my brothers and sister and I to want to become police officers. And at one time we had 9 family members on the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department at the same time. So we definitely took a different path than our father, who has since passed. But I always knew I wanted to serve. I always knew I wanted to protect. So I went in the military at 17, became a cop at 21, and I'm turning 51 here next month. And I don't regret a day of service. Besides being a police officer, I've also authored several things. I co-authored a law enforcement textbook with Jack Colwell, That book is titled Unleashing the Power of Unconditional Respect. And that was a great experience. We're actually, we haven't actually announced this to anyone, but we're currently working on a second edition of that book. So I'm real excited about that work. It's going back and revisiting some of the things that we said back in 2010. They were so prescient. You know, things that we talked about are now coming to fruition in the law enforcement space, especially in the area of community relations. So it's neat to go back and revisit some of that and kind of add some of the things we've learned in the past decade to that. As you said, senior consultant with the Arbiter Institute, that's a international conflict resolution, conflict transformation organization. And then I've, you know, make my rounds with the IACP and ILETA and some of those other professional organizations. I maintain membership there. I speak for those organizations occasionally, and married to my wife, Shelly, who her and I live here in Kansas City, Missouri, two grown sons and a 14-year-old stepson. And that's me. That's me in a nutshell, Dean, Kelly.
Hey, well, you know, Chip, tell me something that's not in the public bio. Tell me something about you that is not in the public bio.
Well, I'm on my third marriage, and I can tell you that I was married once at 19, very young. I wrecked that marriage by being a totally immature, irresponsible human being. And I got married again because I thought I had a wife selection problem versus a husband behavior problem. And you probably see the train coming. I also wrecked that marriage as well. And I looked around me and I thought, wow, I've got two failed marriages to two very, very good people. My partners were very good people. And when I looked retrospectively at what had happened in the wake of my divorces, I realized I was the common denominator in both of those failed marriages. And it hit me like a ton of bricks and led me to looking at other relationships in my life and things that had gone wrong and what my level of contribution was to those problems. And it was a life-altering discovery that took 20 years. So I don't think that's in the public bio, but it's certainly formative.
Well, I mean, absolutely. It sounds like that was pretty formative there, you know, and it seems like that you learned a lot about yourself, and you're working really, really hard to make this one not a train wreck. So congratulations on that. You know, you know, Chip, you sound like to me, and reading your bio and listening to the information and stuff you talk about, and you do a lot of speaking about leadership, and the fact that you've authored a couple of books and am working on a second version of a book. It seems to me you're a student of leadership. You know, how did that come about? Why? I mean, people just don't generally become students of something unless there's a reason. And how did, you know, would that be accurate to say you're a student of leadership, and why?
Yeah, well, no, it's actually extremely accurate. I'm a philosopher, and philosophy, for those that don't know, that literally means love of knowledge. So I'm very intellectually curious. I have been since a young age. And for me, going to the Army at such a young age, I was kind of a hot-tempered, violent kid at 17. I wasn't really well adjusted because, you know, growing up, I learned that if you have a problem, you deal with it with force, right? And so when I went to the Army, I was exposed to some high quality leaders. And it was so impressive to me the way that they could guide us. And I just became enamored with this idea that you could have such influence over people by demonstrating high character. And I got really curious about it. And then, as you know, the Army is extremely serious about developing leaders at every stage. And I just, going through that process and becoming a young leader myself, I was an E5 buck sergeant at 19. So I promoted rather quickly. Just that whole process, I just realized the more I learned, the less I knew. It's like I thought about, like, you could think about knowledge like an island, right? And so the more you learn, the more real estate you have. The more you learn, the bigger that island gets. But the bigger the island gets, the bigger the shoreline of ignorance, right? The more you know, the more there is to know. And so really this learning you talk about, it's never ending. I mean, there is no finish line. We're playing in game theory what's called an infinite game. You don't win leadership, right? some people drop right. off because they lose motivation or they don't maintain current knowledge and they drop off, they become irrelevant or unhelpful, but there's no winning it. It's a continuous game. And so to your point, I do consider myself a student of leadership, and I hope to be a student of leadership for a long, long time to come.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what's interesting about that is that what I found when I'm a student of leadership or whatever I'm a student of, it keeps me relevant enough to stay in the game. And when you become a student of it, you really never run out of stuff to learn, nor do you learn out of challenges, because it seems like the more you learn, the more challenges you want to take on. It's kind of crazy, but it's like that, you know? And I think that we're all born with that natural curiosity that a lot of times, though, a lot of us cut it off because life gets in the way of our curiosity and we kind of settle in. But I think if you're going to stay sharp at something or you're going to get really good at something, you got to be a student of it. Do you agree with that?
You know, I agree 100%, especially in an environment like ours, an environment that's characterized by complexity. You know, things are in constant flux. There's changes all the time. And, you know, you have to adopt this mindset of being adaptable. Things are, you know, whatever got you here isn't going to get you there, not in this environment. And so I do believe what you're saying is there's so much truth packed into that. You know, you adapt or die, as it were. You know, I think that a lot of people conflate, you know, when Charles Darwin talked about in The Origin of Species, when he talks about survival of the fittest, people think that that means the strongest, but actually it means that, you know, survival of those that are most easily can more easily adapt. Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Kelly. Thank you. Those are the words for the things I was trying to say, Kelly.
Right. Yeah.
Well, Kelly would do a good job. Kelly would do a good job of finishing your sentences for you.
Hey, I tell you what,
it's not to be intended.
Well, Kelly's good at that because she's a lifelong learner too, and she pushes knowledge all the time, and she does a great job for us of constantly staying current in what's going on and keeping up. I mean, it really is a lifeblood for us. So I'm just getting used to it. You know what I'm saying? It's like she just finishes sentences for me.
Well, I love it because I learn through articulation. So as we conversate like this, you know, that's how I like people to clarify things, and I can get a little bit verbose occasionally, especially in the afternoon. So,
well, you know, and Kelly just kills it for us. And she, if anybody ever needed any research stuff, man, she's already ahead of the game. Like she really does it well. So, and you know what I think, and we were talking about earlier, we were talking about, you said something about the Army does a really good job of preparing leaders. You know, Chip, why doesn't law enforcement do the same thing? You know, we call ourselves para-freaking military and we call ourselves, you know, all these things. Why do we do? And you may disagree with me, but I'm of the opinion we're getting better, but I'm also of the opinion that we are years and years behind preparing leaders in our organizations. And you may disagree, but why do you think that is?
I don't disagree. Dean, not at all. I think, honestly, you're being much more charitable than I would be. My experience is we do a pitiful job of preparing leaders. Most of the time we're promoting people because they did a really good job in their current role. So we reward them by letting them participate in assessment centers and promoting into supervisory roles, which, you know, you could be great at doing the job. That doesn't mean you're great at supervising people doing the job. Mm-hmm. And it certainly doesn't mean you're great at commanding people doing the job and thinking strategically. So I think we do a pitiful job. And as far as why, I've got all kinds of theories around that. But I will say that it probably begins from the academy and the way we approach academy training. The requirements to be a police officer, as a matter of fact, take the state of Missouri, for example, the longest academies we have are 6 months. That mm-hmm. is the longest academy we have is 6 months. And I tell you what, after 30 years, I'm starting to believe that 6 months is not near enough time to train a police officer. And, you know, I don't think they're paid well enough. I don't think they're trained well enough from the very, very beginning. And I don't think that we have established like leadership pipelines or career development pipelines where we could say, hey, look, Dean, you come on, you know, you're a couple of years on the job. You declare you want to be a supervisor. Okay, we're going to put you in a pipeline. We're going to start preparing you for that role gradually and putting you into situations that you can exercise leadership traits We're going to help you build those into your way of operating. We don't do it. I think it's some of it's just professionally, we've been lazy. We operate under an industrial age management mindset that has not been updated and refreshed, certainly not at the pace that it needs to be. I think we see a lot of that currently. The expectations of the community have changed at a much greater rate than our approach to how we manage ourselves and how we respond to community expectations. So I think it's just part of the culture. I it's so trite, but I've heard it said so many times, that's the way we've always done it. Or back when I was in the academy, we did this, and we're taking too many looks in the rearview mirror, and we're not going that way.
Let's take a short break from the show, and we'll be right back.
Hi, Straight Talk listeners. This is Kelly Corbin, Director of Business Development at LHLN, and we thank you so much for listening to Dean's podcast every week. We just continue to grow our listenership, and that's thanks to you sharing and liking and subscribing to that podcast. Wanted to let you know that at LHLN, we are all about growing future leaders. So don't hesitate to reach out to us if it's a specific need that you have organizationally or leadership development-wise. We want to be there to help. So hop on our website, www.lhln.org, and fill out a form or give me a call. Now, back to the show.
Yeah, you know, I find that interesting that you know, you've said a lot of things there. And I like, you know, because it's almost you use the verbiage that you put kind of makes it in simplistic and understanding when you say industrial age mindset. And that mindset is, and I may be wrong when you said, but when I hear that, I think of paternalistic mindset of you do it because I say to do it. And it's because that's the way we've always done it, which is the industrial age mindset, if you will.
Yeah.
It certainly isn't the one of partnership, which is the predominant way that we're looking at leadership now. But I always talk about leadership, and I say, if you were to compare law enforcement and medicine, if medicine handled the way it developed medicine, the way we develop law enforcement leaders, we would all be dead. Because we would never develop things. Because in law enforcement, we put you straight into execution mode prior to doing any training, prior to do anything else. And we just take a guy that goes from the night shift person to tomorrow night, he's the leader of the night shift in a supervisory role. And we basically say, execute that. And I think that's dangerous. I think it's irresponsible. And I think that we do have to find a way to really get out of that. And this is the one thing that I personally kind of take, not from me personally, but my generation should take the blame for that, because my generation, we were taught that we should have seen better than that. I hope the new generations understand, you know, no more would you expect a person to go to surgery the first day of training, would you expect a person to handle a homicide and be able to do a really good job at effectively supervising people in life or death situations. So, I mean, you know, you get that with me, but you know, we all know we got that problem, but it's kind of interesting. You said something to me earlier when we were just chatting before we came online, you said something about you look for opportunities to discuss or scale the philosophy of your leadership, you know? And I thought that was like, I like that. So help our listeners understand what that means.
Yeah. Well, so I developed a leadership philosophy, a personal philosophy for approaching leadership. Jack and I captured a lot of it in the book. And of course it's an ongoing project. I'm constantly revising and rethinking my philosophy. But when I implemented at the level of squad supervisor in the SWAT teams, they told me it wouldn't work. And it did work, and it worked spectacularly. Then when I promoted to the command ranks and I led a watch, they said it wouldn't work, but it did work. It scaled. And then when I became a division commander, they said, well, that's, you know, you can't know everybody in your division, therefore it won't work. But lo and behold, it is working. And so my instincts are, it's not just me. I'm just not like a total hypothetical, because I've seen these level five leaders out there do this in other industries. I could name one, Alan Mulally at Ford. When Alan Mulally led the Ford turnaround back in 2009, amazing leader. He did it at Boeing. He did it at Ford. He, you know, I believe that an entire organization with the right leadership at the top and the right philosophy in the executive team, an entire organization can be transformed by leaders who are willing to see people, who are willing to understand that the people they're working for matter. They're not objects to be moved around on a game board. They're people with feelings. They've got fears, hopes, dreams, insecurities, and being able to meet them where they're at, see them as humans, build strong relationships, engender trust, be very, very clear about who does what by when you're dictating things, be accountable rather than trying to hold people accountable, helping them be self-accountable for the mission. I believe you can do that. It doesn't matter the size of the organization. You just might have to work through more people and get more buy-in from your direct reports. But I'm excited for the opportunity, if the opportunity pops up, to, you know, retire from KCPD and maybe step into another organization that might need that type of help, that type of leadership. But no, I really do believe that, you know, if you get the foundational stuff right, that you're recognizing the personhood of every team member, if you get that right, there's no upper limit to what you can accomplish as a team. But again, it requires stepping back from what you and I have referred to as that industrial age management mindset, where we just see people as, you know, objects to be manipulated, you know, back when they first started the first assembly line, right? You know, it didn't matter. You weren't a person. You were just a cog in a machine. Well, people never really responded well to that. They never really felt that the work was meaningful, caused a lot of burnout, probably a lot of shortcuts, probably a lot of inefficiencies that fell out that resulted from that. But today, with millennials and the newer aged employees that are coming on, they won't accept it. You know, they won't accept that type of leadership. They will rebel against you. They will build their resistance to you into their obedience. They will do things that are maniacal and undermining. They'll go find other jobs, right? They'll leave industries. In order to for this thing to be sustained the way we need it to be, I really think we need to embody this philosophy. So from the top down, and that's what I meant by scaling, from the top down.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Kelly, go ahead.
Well, what I was going to do is I wanted to back up for just a second. You were talking about the tracks that are not really evident in law enforcement, where you would early on look at those people. And I love your whole idea about the personhood thing. I've just come out of a phase in my life where I was very active in local schools, and I see a very similar pattern in how we're handling public education and teachers and administrators, and the same thing in law enforcement, where you're taking somebody that's very excited to come into the role of law enforcement or teaching, but we're not rewarding what their true passion is. For example, you might have an officer who is just a bang up school resource officer, but they know that there is a limit to how much income they can make in that position. But they may not really want to be a commander, but they know that in order to retire at a more generous rate of pay, that they have to go up that ladder. And so you eventually have the Peter principle creep in. And I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on that, in terms of, is that kind of where you're heading, is that we should be looking at these different tracks and saying, you know, there is a value in having really good, competent school resource officers or really competent tactical people that are in SWAT and want to stay in SWAT, versus somebody that is much more effective at being a strategic thinker and a strategic planner for the organization?
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I've met some career road officers that, you know, the only job they ever did was work in patrol and answer 911 calls. They were amazing.
Right.
They were better at that job, the nuts and bolts of that job, than some of the people that were supervising them, even though some of the people that were supervising them were really good. Mm-hmm. And the skills with human beings to be good supervisors and managers, and they were smart enough to defer to the people they were supervising in certain tactical situations. So yes, to your point, I think we need to incentivize that better. We tried in Kansas City. We went through a phase where they developed a new rank, Master Patrol Officer, and the idea was to throw a little bit more money, a little bit more responsibility, not a lot more, but a little bit more, at some of the folks that wanted to make a career out of just being line officers. I thought it was a pretty good idea. I think that program is kind of, through attrition, you know, it's kind of dying out due to funding and different contemporary concerns we're having around finances. But no, I think you're right. We need to find a way to incentivize it. And on the flip side, we need to help people who are prospective leaders understand that the money is not the main reason to pursue this. Right. Because here's right. the thing, you know, we got to have some accountability in leadership ranks, which historically we don't have, you know. But I mean, if you show up as a leader and you're not accomplishing the job, you're not effective. We need to let them know that there's no guarantee you're going to stay in that role. You may promote to sergeant, you may promote to captain, but if you aren't performing adequately, you know, there's no guarantee you're going to stay at that rank. You can always be demoted or reassigned. We don't do that near enough.
Yeah,
we just don't, right? It's like once you make it, you make it. And that's unfortunate.
Well, I think one of the biggest problems with law enforcement is the fact that we really don't incentivize staying where you are. You have to promote in order to remunerate or, you know, your own self or make yourself make more money, have a better car, have a better schedule. Those things come with the ranks, if you will. And there's no real reason why people should stay where they are other than the fact, but the money is a situation for law enforcement, no doubt about it. I mean, there is no question. And one of the things I like is the fact that it seems like you're well-read. Because I'm listening when you're talking about infinite versus finite game. You're talking about five levels leader. You're talking about Jim Collins. You're talking about Simon Sinek. You're talking about John Maxwell. I mean, you're listening to all those guys. And those are things that, you know, I really like in leadership. And I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. And I want to hear, you know, Chip, and you've got obviously got a lot of experience and you got a lot of knowledge going on there with leadership, just through probably the same thing as most of us, scar tissue. And what I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and I want to kind of hear your response to those, because I think every cop right now feels paralyzed to some degree because they don't know if what they do is going to be supported by the community or by the organization or administration. So they're a little bit paralyzed. And I think leaders are paralyzed. I think they're paralyzed on how do I lead in a really volatile environment, you know? And what would you say? Let's say that Chip, you've got the opportunity. You've had nothing, no conversations with an individual before. You don't have any relationship with the individual. Don't have any of that. But you're handed a new leader tonight, and this is their first shift. What would you say to them?
Yeah. Well, the first thing, and I've been in that situation many times, Dean. My organization is large enough that I don't always know the people personally that end up working on my team. But the first thing I tell my leaders is, look, the key to your influence, to your ability to inspire, is going to be based on the quality of your relationships. And this is slow, deep work, but I would encourage them to start building relationships immediately. And to start getting to know people that are reporting to them, to get really curious with them. One of the things I assign my new leaders I have them conduct what I call meet to learns, where they go out and meet with their people, not to get something from them, but to learn how they can be more helpful. To ask questions it's so powerful, Kelly. And to ask questions like for instance, Kelly, let's say that you were on my team and you reported to me, I might come to you and say, Kelly, could you tell me what are some of the aspects of your job that really kind of drive you crazy? Just the stuff where you look around and you think, man, things could be done so much better. Listen to you and your responses, mm-hmm. right? And I might say something like, well, Kelly, could you tell me what could someone in my position do to make your job more difficult? Yeah. And you're going to have all kinds of ideas about what I can do. Then I can reverse engineer that, right?
And is it, right.
What kind of things, Kelly, might you need help with? And then I might ask, I love this question. Kelly, at what cadence would you like me to check in with you to see how things are going?
Right.
Because what happens is a lot of times, you know, as a new leader, to Dean's point, you meet people, you might start off on the right foot, but you lose momentum. You know, you don't schedule these follow-ups. So next thing you know, it's 2-3 months. You haven't even talked to some of the people on your team, right? Trust is, it's a delicate thing. It has to be nurtured and cultivated. You know, and what do we always say to extend that gardening metaphor? What do you need to do to get weeds in your garden? Nothing, right? Weeds are going to come if you do nothing. So the idea is that you and I have to be constantly working that relationship. So back to Dean's question, that's the first thing I tell them. You got to build relationships. That is the foundation for trust. And trust is what you're going to leverage to get everything you do done. because, you know, we're not in an environment. It's not an assembly line. I'm not standing over you watching your every move.
Right.
It isn't a simple environment of complication where you pull this lever and it results in this outcome. It's totally, totally different than that. So I want to be able to have someone who trusts me, someone who believes that I have their best interest in mind. It's mission first, people always. That's it, right? And so that's the first thing I would tell a new leader. The other thing I would tell them is, look, it's really important that you get very technically competent at your job. You should do something each day to increase your acumen, your knowledge in your role. People sometimes they tend to just gravitate towards the things they're comfortable with. So if you got a SWAT officer that gets promoted, they tend to gravitate more towards the tactical stuff. And they completely ignore the budgetary, fiscal kind of lane. It's not comfortable there, so they don't want to go there. Well, you have to jump into what you're uncomfortable with. You have to make sure that you've got good range. So I would encourage them to do something each day to increase their technical knowledge. And then also to go outside the unit and figure out, who does your work impact? Who's impacted by the work you do each day? Find out who those stakeholders are. Go meet with them. Do meet to learns with them. It could be people in the community. It could be people, you know, in other units and other departments and other agencies, federal, state, local. But just make a habit of, build in a daily habit of trying to increase your knowledge each day, both in the technical space and the relationship space.
Thank you for listening to Straight Talk on Leadership with Dean Crisp. Make sure you like and subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss an episode. You can go to www.lhln.org to find upcoming classes where you can book Dean for his new class. And you can also check out his new book, Essential Leadership Lessons from the Thin Blue Line. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.